Date, March 26th of 07. March 29th of 07, thanks. And first off, we're going to rearrange the schedule a little bit. The first order of business is going to be we're going to open a work session on 2962 for one purpose, to move that bill, so I would entertain
it. Do we have a quorum?
There's four of us.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move that we refer House Bill 2962 without recommendation to the House Committee on Economic and Workforce Development.
Okay. Representative Clem has moved that we move the House Bill 2962 without recommendation to the Committee on Economic and Workforce Development. Is there any discussion?
Well, Mr. Chair, I assume since you're a chief co-sponsor, this is a good idea.
The other chief co-sponsor on this bill requested that of me, and I said I would be glad to do that for him. He happens to be on the other committee and would love to have this bill there. So,
God, Molly, let's vote.
Okay. So, with that, we'll take a roll call vote.
Representative Dinkfelder.
Excused.
Representative McPherson.
Excused.
Representative Maurer.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Excused.
Representative Oakwood?
Aye.
Representative Glenn?
Aye.
Chair Roblin?
Aye. Motion passes, and we will send that to the other committee.
We're all co-sponsors.
So next, we're going to close that work session on House Bill 2962, and we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2373. And with that, I'll let you give a short explanation, and then we'll have Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Chair, and I will defer to Representative Gelser for the more thorough description of this bill, but it does, HB 2373 does allow continuous lots that are combined for forest fire protection assessment purposes to have family dwellings and apparatus structures improvements if a combination of lots does not total more than 20 acres. We also do have some amendments with this. There are some, I believe, dash one and dash two amendments, and I believe the dash twos may be Representative Gelser, so I will defer to her for those explanations if that's okay.
That would be great.
Thank you.
So, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Representative Sarah Gelser, and I represent House District 16, which is Corvallis and Philomath, and two individuals who live in Linn County. It's a great honor to be here before this committee today. My work doesn't often bring me before the Agricultural and Natural Resources Committee. I wish that it brought me here more often. And I wanted to give you a little bit of background as to why I've brought this bill. In November of 2005, about 2,500 landowners in my legislative district received letters informing them that they were newly subject to the forest fire protection assessment fee. This is a small fee, relatively, but it was very concerning to the individuals who received the letters, some of whom didn't understand why their land would be classified as forest fire land and be eligible for forest fire protection. I held a town hall. We had over 100 people turn out to this town hall, worked with the Department of Forestry. As a result of many of those conversations, the extension of that classification was suspended until such time there's a larger work group that's going to look more closely at the definitions for land classification for these purposes. Many of those issues are very complicated as our communities continue to grow out into more rural areas, and we've got many more places where you've got an urban and forested land interface. Some of the questions that I hope will be addressed by that larger committee that is being formed and is going to continue to meet through the interim are questions like how to best put together our fire protection resources so that our structures are protected, our forests are protected, and we're not having unnecessary duplication of fire resources and having people duplicatively pay for rural fire protection district or city fire services and rural fire protection district services. However, after working with the Department of Forestry, there was one outstanding issue, which is that's here in House Bill 2373 that seemed like low-hanging fruit that could be taken care of during this legislative session. And that is that when you are a property owner and your land is assessed for the forest fire protection fee, it doesn't matter what the size of your property is, you're charged that same base fee, which I am embarrassed to admit I did not bring that number with me. However, you're charged that same base fee. That doesn't matter if your property is 1 acre or if your property is 100 acres. However, you're charged that same base fee for each new parcel of property that you have. So for constituents that contacted me who had lived for a long time on a large, they considered themselves to have large acreage, but it was broken up maybe 15 acres into four different tax lots. They were paying that assessment fee on those four tax lots. And the concern was that this was not equitable because very large landowners would then be paying less than these relatively small landowners because of the pile on of that fee for each time. So what this bill essentially says is that if you live in a single dwelling home and that home is located on up to 20 acres on multiple contiguous lots, you are assessed as if that's a single property. You're not paying that same fee each time. The amendments allow that to include the extra buildings that might be there related to the house. Those of us in Human Service Committees aren't as familiar with pronunciation of that word. What I want to make sure is true in the amendments and in the bill, and I hope that the committee can help me with this, the intent is that when a landowner comes and makes application to have their property for the purposes of the forest fire assessment considered to be consolidated, that they are paying a fee that covers the cost of that initial determination so that this does not become an additional cost for the county. In fact, right now, an individual could come each year, pay a fee, and have that determination made, but the next year they would need to come and do it again. This is cumbersome for the landowner, but I have also heard from those that make that assessment. Department of Forestry talked about that's pretty cumbersome for them, especially when you're talking about an extraordinarily small amount of revenue. So this isn't, I also want to be clear, this isn't something that's pulling significant revenue out of the Forest Fire Protection Fund in any way. We're talking about a bill that will affect not a large number of people, but what it does is provide for equity between small landowners and large landowners, because at the end of the day, if you're living on 8 acres, you shouldn't be paying up to five times as much as someone that's living on 80 acres of land. That's simply not fair. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
We're going to have ODF and some other people here to ask some questions of. And I guess what I would say, you know, my understanding was that for forest fire protection, you pay a fee based on per acre. So people pay a per acre charge, as well as they pay an extra charge if they have structures on that facility.
Mr. Chair, my understanding, if I'm recalling correctly, it's been about a year now since I worked on this issue. Once your property is over a certain amount, you would pay that per acre. But on these small acreages, and there's two fees. There's the fee that's on your property. There's also the fee that's on your structure. So you have an additional fee to cover the additional cost of protecting the structure. And I'm sure that ODF can address those questions differently. In my district, the effect has been people that live on smaller parcels of land, because of the pile-on of assessing each tax lot, are in fact paying more, not just per acre, but more in dollars than people who own substantially larger tracts of land.
And I'll ask you one other question. In your town hall and the other kinds of stuff you've had, was it taken into consideration that in forest land, having structures and trying to protect those create problems for fighting fires?
Yeah.
It costs more when they are there?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that was discussed, and I became a big proponent of the Forest Fire Protection System. Oregon Department of Forestry made me keenly aware in my legislative district, Vineyard Mountain, which is very near to my home, is a place that I'm very concerned about the fire safety on that property, the ability to protect those structures, and the increased risk that inhabitants bring to those areas. In my legislative district, for many of these homes, they're places that are kind of adjacent to these types of lands, and that was what a lot of the conversation was about. I mean, we had someone that came to the town hall and said, why am I in a forest fire protection district when I don't have trees on my property? But we had conversations about the brush and the overgrowth and things that are hanging over. The Department of Forestry did an excellent job responding to the constituents in my district, and I think really is to be commended for their efforts in education about fire safety and how we, through our residences, impact the safety to our forests and to ourselves by being out there.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just to clarify, make sure I understand, because this is all coming back to me painfully now. I just want to recall what we're talking about, what you're trying to correct here. These individuals are already in a rural fire department already, are they not?
And this, Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, this bill does not address that particular issue. That is an issue that was raised, and I mentioned that earlier. Not all of these individuals, but in my legislative district and in the places where ours abut, this might also be true. I'm fortunate to have a lot of overlapping territory with Representative Boquist and Representative Olson. There are individuals who are subject to the forest fire assessment, but they are also paying into the rural fire protection district. And that's been a concern from those community members. It's also been a concern raised by the members of the Corvallis Rural Fire Protection District Board. It's also an issue that's been raised by the city of Corvallis because there are a handful of properties that received notice that they were going to be subject to the forest fire assessment that were actually within the city and were covered by the Corvallis Fire Department. The other question that was raised was, what is the most realistic way to manage these fire protection resources? Because in effect, if there is a structural fire, it's going to be the Rural Fire Protection District or the Corvallis Police Department, the Corvallis Fire Department in my district that's going to go out and fight that residential fire because of the cooperative agreements that have been put together between the Rural Fire Protection District, the city, and the Department of Forestry. And the Department of Forestry was very helpful in attempting to resolve those concerns, but those aren't concerns that are specific to my district or your district and have very significant statewide implications and didn't fall into that area of low-hanging fruit like this one is, which is, you know, charge the people for living on their 20 acres instead of as if they hung on others. But I'm glad that you raised that, and I do think that that's a very important issue for us to be paying attention to when this interim group comes back.
Yes,
just follow up more of a comment, and if I recall correctly, and Representative Gilles can correct me wrong, there's actually a small third category, which is people who work not in city, rural, but we're expecting, without paying, that the State Department of Forestry would somehow use brush pumpers to rescue their houses, too. I remember there was a small group that we share along that outer edge towards the coast in which there is no fire protection district, but they believe somehow that the Department of Forestry is going to be sending a pumper out there on Christmas Day to put out chimney fire.
Right, Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, that's true, and one of the other problems that was raised is we do have people very close to our legislative districts, right outside of, in an area that abuts, it actually might be in your legislative district and right outside of mine, that currently are not covered by any fire protection at all, and that also is part of this larger question, how do we coordinate our fire protection resources to best protect our citizens and best protect all of us from very costly and dangerous forest fires and wildland fires.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank
Any
you.
Other questions? Thank you. And as we keep going, the next person we'll call is Charlie Stone from ODL. While Charlie's coming up here, I hope I made this announcement. 2293, if you're here for that bill, the amendments did not come to us that were expected today, so we are putting that off till next Tuesday.
Yeah, and without recommendation to workforce
development. So next Tuesday we'll hear that bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Charlie Stone, policy analyst with the Department of Forestry Fire Protection Program. I think maybe I'll start out by just playing off of Representative Gelser's testimony and saying that in terms of the assessment, yes, the assessment, each district sets a rate that will develop enough money to provide an adequate level of protection for that district. And that's divided by the number of acres in the district, and that establishes an annual assessment rate. For sake of ease, let's say that that rate in a given district is $1 an acre. If you own 100 acres, you're going to pay a $100 assessment for that property for that year. If you own only 8 acres, and that would only bring it up to an $8 assessment, there is a requirement in the law that there's a minimum of $18 per lot, and $15 of that goes to the district, as does the others, and $3 of that goes into the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund, which is the emergency funding. So what we're talking about here are those lots actually in the northwest area in West Oregon District where Representative Gelser's from. I think the assessment rate currently is somewhere in the neighborhood of 67 cents, 70 cents an acre. So an even larger parcel up to 18, 20 acres is going to come under that minimum. Under the current law, if you want to combine lots, you're allowed to do that if there aren't any structures on those lots and if there isn't any anything in the works in terms of development of those lots for structures or a subdivision. The proposed amendment, or excuse me, the bill that Representative Gelser brought forward would say also that if you live on that and have a structure or pertinent structures and your lot is your combined lots would be less than 20 acres, then you can have that combined, and so you only pay one minimum. And from a fairness standpoint, well, as an example, I live here in Salem, so I'm not out there in ODF land, but I've got a fifth of an acre lot, but it's actually two lots as it's described, and so I live on half of one lot and half of another lot. And I can understand completely the notion of wanting to be able to combine those, not have to pay two minimum assessments. And we have no problem with the proposal. We met with Representative Gelser early in the session to make sure we understood what she was trying to do and propose that, well, if this is the case, we also ought to pay attention to the fact that there's another statute that requires a $38 surcharge for any approved lots. If we're now going to combine lots that have structures on them, this is going to get really complicated with the assessors, but we said that if you qualify under the proposal that Representative Gelser has put forward, then we probably also ought to recognize that as long as they are pertinent structures, for instance, your house is on one lot and your barn and garage are on the other lot and you're combining those, then it ought to be viewed as one lot for the purposes of the improved lots as well. So we helped develop the Dash 1 amendments. The Dash 2s are very similar in nature. We don't have a preference between them or see any significance in either one of them. Would point out that both the Dash 1 and the Dash 2s probably still have a minor flaw in them, and that they, by creating a new Section 1 to the bill, the amendment recognizes and renumbers Section 1 to Section 2, but it doesn't recognize and renumber Section 2 to Section 3, so you'd have two Section 2s in the bill. I would point out, in addition to all that, Representative Gelser acknowledged the classification study that the department is engaged in, and right now we have Class 1, 2, and 3 forest land. Anything that the Department of Forestry protects has to first be acknowledged as forest land, which basically means it's got vegetation on it that would carry a fire and require protection. And this system was designed back in the 60s, and it only recognizes timberlands and grazing lands. And, of course, we've had a tremendous influx of homes into particularly the timberlands over those years. We've got all kinds of areas in the state we call the wildland-urban interface. They have lots of structures in them. It's confounding the whole business of fire protection, and we're really kind of wondering, where should the lines be drawn? When is it appropriate for the Department of Forestry to be there and provide protection? When is it not? And on the other end of the spectrum, we've dealt with unprotected land. Where should that boundary come? So this study that we're doing in the next year is really trying to look at all that and figure out where should we be drawing the lines, what's the right role for the Department of Forestry, how do we fund all of that. And we're trying to get that work done by the end of the calendar year 2008 so that any recommendations we have that could affect legislation will be ready to come here for the 2009 session. So that's our effort with that study. I think those are the clarifications I hope to make. I'd be happy to answer any questions for the committee.
Any questions? Yes, Representative Dingfeld.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for being late. I had a question, though, because Charlie referenced the Dash 1s, which we don't seem to have. So can you maybe explain what they are? And
well,
I think you said they're pretty similar to the Dash 2s, so I was like, was that you put in and then the representative put them in?
Apparently that's how it came about. The difference is in the language. In the Dash 2s that you have in front of you, it says on page 1, line 19, and whose owner has made application to the state forester under ORS 477-295. The Dash 1s say and qualifies under ORS 477-295. And I'm not sure that there's any technical difference that would make one or the other better. We don't have a preference, certainly.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you. And currently the last person that we have to speak on this is Dave Lawson from Yamhill County Assessor's Office. Thank you for coming.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, distinguished committee members. My name is David Lawson. I'm Yamhill County Assessor Tax Collector. I'm second vice president of the Oregon State Assessors Association. I'm here today just to talk about the impact this has on some counties as far as workload. Right now, many of the counties in our state are about ready to reduce their assessment and taxation staff. This language that was submitted to the addendum to this about applications and ownership helps some, but our concern is there's a committee form in process to report back January of 08 on this topic. We would like to allow that committee to do their work and come forward at that time with their recommendations. Right now, Benton County, myself, many counties are reducing our staffs. So this is ownership. When we talk about ownership, mom and dad, daughter and son, there's a lot of verification that we have to go through, because if mom and dad are in one parcel and son is on another and daughter on another, to us, we would say that that's not one owner. I suspect other people would say, yes, it is one owner. So we're looking at it from a FTE standpoint at this point, that we don't have the resources. We're currently implementing, working with the Department of Forestry, of course, on those accounts that come in, and we collect a fee and we certify and send the monies off. Some counties charge the Department of Forestry, I've been told today. I don't, where I live. We do the work and we do it well, and I never considered charging the Department of Forestry for the work, but at some point in time we're going to have to make a realization on workloads statewide and the impact it may have. And it's a data management impact. When we get an application and there's some broken chain of ownership, then we have disgruntled taxpayers to deal with also. I think this process of having an application to set out the ownership would certainly clean up some of the language. But I guess from an association standpoint, I was asked to come forward this afternoon and voice our concerns about it may be premature to do this with this committee work going. It will have an impact on counties statewide. And when I say that, I will say that it's going to be a negative, because we don't have the resources currently to do any more than we are really doing, many of us. And you're well aware of that with ONC revenue. So that was our concern from an association standpoint.
Okay. Representative Boquist.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, to make sure I understand, the way I read either the amendment of the main bill, the landowners who have, let's say, three parcels, hypothetically, will make application to the state forester, and from there, help me out. The state forester is then going to send notification to the county.
It's going to send me the tax lots, parcel size, ownership. And, of course, if it's clean, good data, we would be able to process it. Many times, though, family trusts are created. Go ahead.
And what's different from what we're doing now?
Right now, we don't look at contiguous parcels. We've got 7 acres. A new home is permitted. We go out. We pick the new home up. We put 5 acres into the fire patrol, take the 5 acres out of the fire patrol, do our work. With this bill, we're going to have to know contiguous ownership that we currently don't consider. And it may not sound like much, but
so
it's another process that we'd have
so
to...
Currently, you would be sending him a bill for each one of those tax lots.
Yes, that's correct.
And this one would say certain times you would send it to each tax lot, and other times, if they had gotten this gone through this process, you would send it not to each one, but only to the one that was had the house on it or whatever.
We feel the current process of a surcharge for each tax lot is equitable and good business.
Further questions? Yes, Representative Bocas.
Paul, this year. I'm trying to get an envisionment here because I know that it's a statewide problem, but it's not a... I guess my question to the chair is not of the assessor. Has LFO done an analysis or has...
How much money this would be? We have not got one.
Cost impact from the Department of Forestry? Some sort of assessment? So are we talking one case a year, 10 cases a year, 20 cases a year?
Yeah.
Something along that line.
Have not had one. Okay. Question?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative
the impact,
Mauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The impact would be at the local assessor's office and not at the state level, and therefore the impact, the state, LFO would not have an impact necessarily.
Okay. It would have an impact because currently each one of those tax lots is getting probably the minimum
of $38.
Okay. $38 or whatever.
Understand.
And out of that $38, the state gets $5.03, and so they would lose some of those fives and threes.
There'd be some impact. From our position, it's a workload issue for us.
Right. Representative Bogle.
Yeah, unless I'm missing something, then I don't see Representative Gelser back. The intent here is that this bill, hypothetically passed, would allow an individual landowner to petition by application to the state forester. The state forester then would either agree, concur, whatever, at which point the state forester then would send notification to the county assessor. And so there would be, some sort of revenue. There's two things. First, there's a fiscal impact in regards to dealing with the state and the Department of Forestry. Then the next question is, which is a local issue, is then there is an LRO revenue impact on what would be the loss and anticipation of what revenue the counties, cities, and the various departments would lose in local governments and fire protection districts. Mr. Chair, that's just a counter of, if there's 10 people, then there's not much to this.
Right.
There's 500.
That's getting to be.
500 is the cost of a handful of training or a payment on a pumper or something.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We have one other person who would like to speak. McNitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt, and I represent the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. I'm sure many of my members were some of the constituents that Representative Gelser met with in her town hall. I hadn't planned to actually testify on this bill today, but we are supportive of House Bill 2373. But what really made me kind of itch is an opportunity to talk to you about fire costs in general and what forest landowners pay, because it's complicated and it's very expensive and it's very important to us as a program. But I heard some concern about maybe overlapping duties or responsibilities, and I wanted to share with you that and by the way, there are some very esteemed people in this room, so it's a little bit nerve-wracking to explain fire costs when Bart Starker is right behind me on the Emergency Fire Cost Committee. But as forest landowners, people pay a base protection in their forest protection district, and that covers costs of fighting fire to protect trees. And then, in addition to that, landowners also pay into something called the Forest Land Protection Fund, which is for catastrophic fire. And that is a revenue source. I think there are five different taxes. Part of that's the harvest tax. Part of it's a minimum lot tax. Part of it's a structure or an improved lot tax, and part of it's an acreage tax. And that kicks in when there's catastrophic fire that overwhelms the local fire protection district. And the reason I'm explaining that is because for the improved lots and for the structures, those extra fees aren't to protect those structures. The fees are recognition that it significantly increases the complexity of fighting the fire, and so it's harder to protect the trees. And it may sound kind of ruthless, but you might have a $600,000 lovely home among timber, but that value is nothing compared to the timber that burns up, for which there is no insurance. And many times my landowners, my members, that's their retirement, that's their largest investment, and if there's a fire that takes off, there's no way for them to recover the value of that, plus they have to pay for the costs. And that's why, as a state, I think we've recognized a public-private partnership between buying insurance, the state, the legislature helps us buy that insurance, which protects the general fund from runaway costs of catastrophic fire. And again, it doesn't protect the trees or the houses. So rural fire protection districts are also exceedingly important because that's what protects the structures. Yeah. So it is overlapping, but there's a reason it's overlapping, and I just wanted a chance to explain that.
Thank you. Any questions of this witness? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here that would like to speak to House Bill 2848 or 2373? Which one was it? 2373. Seeing none, we will close our public hearing on 2373, and we're going to open a hearing on House Bill 3044. And to begin with, we'll have a short explanation.
Thank you, Chair. House Bill 3044 does have a subsequent referral to revenue, and what it does is increases the emergency cost, fire cost committee fees, and forest production harvest tax for fire suppression purposes. The Fire Land Protection Fund was created in 1960 for landowners to pay costs of fire fighting and beyond those that the local district could afford. The revenues from this fund are assessed on forest land ownership, a surcharge on approved lots and forest products harvest tax. The Emergency Fire Cost Committee supervises and controls the distribution of the monies with the aim to balance these costs to landowners from region to region.
Thank you. So we'll begin with Tim Keith and Bart Stark.
Oh, this is the committee bill.
This is the committee bill. It's part of a group of three bills that we have. This is the one that helps pay for it. Or parts begins that process. Yeah.
Yeah. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, I'm Bart Starker, and I'm the chair of the Emergency Fire Cost Committee for the state, and that committee administers the Oregon Land Protection Fund, which pays for firefighting costs on fires which escape the local fire protection district and initial attack capability and deductibles. So that's what we do about four times a year, is try to administer that fund and get the bills paid on a timely way. We're here to ask you for the assessments from landowners to be increased by 25% to cover the increasing costs of these big fires. There are several reasons for the increase. The main one is that over the years we've had an insurance policy by Lloyd's of London, the only one in the world actually that any state has for catastrophic wildfire. And those premiums were getting out of control. So a few years ago we negotiated a deductible system that changed the system to the point where the landowners now have the first $15 million to pay of the deductible for the policy. The general fund pays the next $10 million, and then there's a $25 million insurance policy on top of that. And the insurance premium is about $1 million, a little over $1 million. So that's the big change was from the landowners used to have a $10 million deductible, and now they have a $15 million deductible. And we haven't changed the the assessments to cover that next $5 million. And so we're having, our fund is suffering a bit because we can't fund that extra $5 million of deductible. At least we can't do it without raising rates, and we don't have, we have ability to raise rates on a temporary basis to cover deficits, but no ability to cover long term. And we think that our landowners would appreciate having a more stable rate than the one that jumps up and down on those bad prior years. So that's the reason for our coming here today. Okay. Escalation in fire severity and inflation in firefighting costs is also a concern. And the federal shift from fire policy and staffing and lack of fuel treatments and management in general on the federal lands puts the state system protected lands at higher risk. More and more rural residences are also complicating fire tactics on these areas. We looked at the long-term trends of our fund and tried to pick a rate that will fund the fires but not build a surplus over time. There are cutoff points in the law that where the fund, if the fund builds to a certain point, then the rate stop drop in half, and there's several kind of trigger points in the law that prevent it from building out of control, and I don't think that's likely lately. So we do believe the landowners would be happier if we had a more stable rate, and that's why we're here to see if we can accomplish that. We also do a number of things to proactively to minimize the costs of these catastrophic fires. We're working with the Forest Service so they can hopefully take more responsibility for fires that move from the Forest Service onto the private protected land. And we're making some progress with that. They seem to be open to considering a RIND concept, where a RIND around the federal lands would be their responsibility if the fire moves from their ownership onto the private land, and help us out with those emergency costs and those kind of situations. We're working with our local forest protective associations to increase their initial attack capability so we can catch this fire small, because the costs are much, much smaller if you can catch them when they're little rather than wait until they get big. It gets really expensive, and the air show is spectacular but expensive. We also have an aggressive but not punitive cost collection system that, where if there's liability involved in a particular fire, where the fire starts from somebody's careless act or something, we do go after those people that have insurance and can help reimburse the fund. So we hope you'll agree with this need and the rate changes to ensure we continue to have the best cooperative fire cost fire system, cooperative fire system, and cost-effective fire protection system in the country. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And we might as well do both, and then we'll have the questions. So, go ahead.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Tim Keith. I'm the Emergency Fire Cost Committee Administrator, and I'm basically here just to help answer questions, along with Bart Starker, who's the chair of the committee.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Boquist.
Yeah, thank you. I do have a question. Just to make sure, I'm fully supportive of this, and obviously we dealt with this whole insurance issue last time around and beat each other fairly heavily early in the last session to make sure we got the policy encumbered and everything put in place, so on and so forth. But, I mean, Bart, you made one comment to me, and I need clarified. I was under the impression from last session and this session that though we raise the rates and they permanently become raised, I thought that the fire committee had the authority already to make a recommendation to the state forester and raise those rates. And I only raise this from the issue that we knew 2 years ago, and as you know, we're now $5 million short. We're trying to catch up real quickly. Is there not statutory authority now for the fire committee to make a recommendation to the state board to raise the rates?
Tim can answer that better than me, but I can.
Chair Roblin, Representative Boquist, members of the committee, in the event that the fund drops below zero, we have the ability to borrow money from the state treasurer and thereby then on a prorated basis, however much increase is needed in those assessed rates,
pay back that
loan in the following year. That's the only authority that we have to raise those rates.
The point of clarification, Mr. Chair, from, and I guess we'll get our esteemed guest administrator to go back and answer this question. The relating clause specifically talks about, you know, raising revenue, three-fifths majority, so on and so forth. And again, I was under the impression that somewhere buried in the law here was the ability to do some revenue increasing on an interim basis. And if we're raising it now, we're not going to get there, and this is a stepstone measure, and we're not necessarily going to get there with this one. Then the question is what authority should the Fire Trust Committee have added to this to ensure that we can get that stair step, and we get, you know, we can't wait till it gets to zero because we're at $20 million now, I think, in the deductible or something.
Well, the fund actually is just barely negative right now. We're only $170,000.
Yeah, a little over.
No, so it's pretty close for the kind of dollars we're talking about, anyway.
Right, that's true.
So we're not in too bad of shape. To my knowledge, Representative Boquist, we don't have the authority to raise rates on a permanent basis for the fund.
Yeah, and it's true. My point is, I mean, you know, we're trying to get between 22.5 and 30 million, and we're at negative 173.
We really, Representative Boquist and Chair Roblin, I don't think our goal is to get to somewhere between 22 and 32. I think we'd be happy with 15.
Well, I'd be happy with 15 too. I mean, the legislative piece says, you know, we, of course, we're trying to get it's in here. So, and you're right, I'd be happy with 15 too. But I just wanted to ensure that the Fire Cost Committee has the authority that between the 2-year period that we're gone, when catastrophic events happens, that we can take care of this issue without calling a special session.
They do have that right. Once the fire happens and you run out of money, right, you can't make an assessment, right?
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, essentially we did staff work. Charlie Stone did that work, and he looked at costs that we've incurred in the last few years, and he determined by his analysis that a $10 million revenue stream into the fund would probably pay for the next several years' worth of fire seasons based on what we've seen in the last 5 to 10 years. $10 million is 25% more than we're getting this now, which is approximately $8 million per year. You know, in a perfect storm, if we start the year with zero, we earn $8 million, yet we spend a full $15 million, we just about have to double our rates the following year. And so we don't want to get into that situation where we're yo-yoing our rates up and down. And we believe a modest increase, enough to get us by, is the appropriate thing to do. With inflationary pressures, we could be back in 3 to 5 years for another modest increase. We don't know that yet.
So, yeah.
Roblin, many years we don't spend our full amount at all. We may have a $2 million year and have $6 million to add back into the fund. So that's our goal, is to have more years like that through cost control and efficiencies we can gain in the whole fire protection system. And everybody not have to raise rates to the full $15 million.
And I want to make it clear, because I think some people I've talked to are uptight that the state has their share. But the way this works is the first $15 million you pay.
Right.
I mean, the citizens pay. It isn't until that's spent that the next $10 million the state pays, except for buying the insurance policy, which the state pays. And so they pay $1 million up front or whatever it costs for this.
And
you split that,
split that half and half.
And that was split half and half. That's what I was thinking, yeah. So in most years, the state pays no money for the fires because it comes within that 15. It is only in those catastrophic years that we get into the others.
Hasn't happened yet.
Oh, that's okay. That's good to know. So we haven't used our policy much?
No.
Okay.
Not Not since the change in deductibles.
Representative Roblin, members of the committee, the last time we used the policy was 2002. And I think that the real success stories and why we want to be conservative with an increase is that we are seeing some positive effects from the severity investments that the legislature has made, from some of these other cost-saving measures. And obviously, it's landowner money.
Right.
We treat that with a great deal of respect, and we want to ask for as little as we feel we need to get by, and let time and the severity program, you know, continue to pay dividends.
Okay.
Just one follow-up question. Indulge me, Mr. Chair. Tim, just and I don't see it in here, a guesstimate or a swag or whatever it is, over the next biennium, when we approve, because I'm optimistic, when we approve this, these rates, so on and so forth, do you have a revenue forecast that you anticipate this will bring in?
Chair Roblin, Representative Boquist, members of the committee, we estimate, and the work was done by the staff, State Forestry, that it'll bring in an additional $2,061,000 a year. And by the way, because
per year,
because of the way it's established, harvest taxes are on a calendar year basis, so it would initiate with January 1 of 2008 with an increase in the harvest tax, followed by the surcharges and the acreage assessments, which would kick in on July 1 of 2008. So these increases wouldn't take effect immediately just because of the fiscal year timing.
Okay. Other questions?
Just clarification. Okay. Sure. So the costs for this fire season are going to continue to run us into the negative, is what you're saying.
Representative Roblin and Representative Boquist, we still have the current revenue sources that are still in regard, and we'll have a new $8.1 million coming in on July 1st. So we'll have that to use for this fire season, and hopefully we'll have a good year.
So that's without the new rate.
Right. The new rate is the $2 million.
Which we give the extra $2 million. So
right.
In general,
it's $8 million. I got it. So it's $10 million per
right.
year.
Per year.
Right. Okay, got it.
That's
great.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right. We were just mentioning we have fire-safe cigarettes now. Cut that down.
So I was the chief co-sponsor that last session, and it died.
Oh.
So.
It should
blow. We hope it will. That's true. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we have Randy Simpson from the Oregon State Fire Marshal's Office. We might as well get there's three others. Do we want Ray to come up and Wilkerson also, OFIC, and Charlie Stone from ODF? We might as well have you all up here and take your testimony.
Oh, we missed somebody there. Yeah. We don't have the bodies to move. Okay.
So,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Randy Simpson, Chief Deputy with the Office of State Fire Marshal. I want to thank you for allowing me to testify. The Office of State Fire Marshal is in support of 3044. We have a wonderful relationship, and we value our partnership with ODF. Through the years, we have continually built our relationship, and they have continually, with our support and our local fire districts throughout the state of Oregon, have developed a very aggressive attack on these fires that develop throughout the state. This gives me an opportunity to provide a little missing element that we need to look to into the future. We can provide create a wildfire survivable environment, and strategic fuel reduction is one of the main means. Last time I testified here for another bill, I brought this out. The Black Crater fire is a great example. It came roaring out of the U.S. forest, unmanaged forest, and with the partnership with the ODF wildfire personnel and our local fire districts that were there providing the conflagration resources, we did a burnout operation on ODF property that was managed, had strategic fuel reduction, and that is what reduced the threat to the structures in the Sisters area. So that can be done. This lot-by-lot way of doing strategic fuel mitigation is not going to get there because it has too many ways around it. So that's something we need to look at into the future and more of. That's our office feels that we can get there, and by making fire-resistive buildings more of a reality than what's out there, the unignitable type structures. And we are working with the insurance industry on that, along with ODF, to educate our citizens and with building codes and fire codes to approach that. One thing that we don't have is a means to fund our structural partners that we mobilize out on conflagrations. Currently, we use, historically, we have used general fund money to reimburse the local fire district's costs of these conflagrations for their firefighters and their equipment. The problem that we seem to hear all the time with our local fire districts is, they have developed a wonderful mutual aid agreement with the U.S. Forest Service, BLM, and Oregon Department of Forestry throughout the state to help with the initial attack on these fires. And during that, the majority of these mutual aid agreements are for about a 24-hour period where the local fire districts, the majority of them being rural in these wildland areas, do not get any funding for this response. They're doing it out of their own pocket. And until we have a conflagration, do they get reimbursed at that time? But again, we are slowing down the conflagration amounts. Our local communities, along with the rural fire protection districts, are working on their community wildfire protection plans. We're doing the strategic fuel reductions. We're getting the mutual aid agreements with our partners. And it is working. We are dropping the amounts and the severity of these conflagrations. But again, the time will come. We need to continue forward and move forward. We're hoping that with the increased cost and mobilizations and the limited resources that we have out there throughout the state in these fire districts, that we can come up in the future of a way of funding, severity funding for structural protection of some form. I'm not here for that today. I'm just throwing that out as an idea in the future. So when I come back to you in a year or two, you'll already be pre-warmed up, per se, as they say. I'm warming the oven, as they say. A lot of these unprotected areas pay for fire protection and with the timber in their assessors, as you heard today, the assessor talking earlier. We are working with the Oregon Revenue Department to work with the county assessors to emphasize if they are getting wildland protection fees that it does not include the structural protection. That's one of the issues we have out there throughout the state in the unprotected areas. People pay the fee and they think their home's protected, but they're not. So we're trying to educate them by working with the Revenue Department and has also worked with ODF to come up with language to specify on their tax statement that this is not for your structural protection. It's for the protection of the natural resources and the firefighting, and on the developed areas, the additional cost that it takes to help protect those structures. But it's not going to extinguish a fire on the structure itself. That's what the structural firefighters do. If there's a mutual aid agreement, which majority of the areas have, I know Baker County, for example, has came up with a 24-hour response plan to cover the whole county. But that is a burden on the local volunteer fire departments out there. It really does put them in harm's way, per se, for the rest of their district, because they are limited on personnel. When the governor declares our conflagrations, again, I need to emphasize that the cost of these conflagrations are the cost of the firefighters and their equipment from the local structural districts that mobilize. They are able to charge their fees through our office as a mechanism to pay them, and then through the general fund, historically, we have provided that funding. So, again, eventually in the future, we'd love to see a reserve set aside, a severity funding or something, for structural protection in the state of Oregon. That I don't want to say that we're like California, but it's been referred to as CDF, but they're changing to CAL FIRE now. They have severity funding, and ODF also does. They move personnel and equipment to areas of threat or potential, high potential. If we could do that, then we could get to some of these rural areas if we have some stabilized funding that could pay for that and maybe put an end to these fires quicker and with less destruction out there. So it's something to think about for in the future. We need to find that funding also for fire prevention and education out there. The balance between prevention and suppression without it can be tilted, and we can have a catastrophic fire someday that will damage or severely ruin all these homes in an area. So we want to make sure that we can address the prevention side, education, and then maybe some standby severity funding of something in the future. But again, the Office of State Fire Marshal supports 3044, and I hope you join us also in support of this bill. We feel it's a wonderful bill, and it's good for the patrons out there that are paying the fees to help stabilize. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Ray Wilkerson, Oregon Forest Industries Council. I'll be very brief. I can't really add very much to what Bart Starker said. We do support this bill. I can't remember if Bart mentioned it or not, but the Emergency Fire Cost Committee is a statutory committee, four-member committee. Currently, three of the four members are representatives of companies that are also members of OFIC, and they are the ones that brought this, recommended this bill to the legislature, so it has our full support. Even though this is one of those bills at the top in the small print says three-fifths majority required because it's a tax increase, the real driver in this bill is not the tax rate so much as the expenditure limitation. And the reason the bill is before you is because that was raised from $10 million to $15 million here two sessions ago. And that makes the revenue stream inadequate under the current rates. But if we have good fire years, we can bank those dollars, and they won't be spent, and we can use them in the future. I think my other comment would be just by way of, for the record or the historical foundation of this, the reason we supported the legislature raising that expenditure limit from $10 to $15 million was the result of an interim committee that met the interim before last. They did a lot of good work evaluating the whole system and recognizing the increased costs that had to be addressed one way or the other. And the upshot of that was, under the theory of shared responsibility, both the forest landowners and the state of Oregon agreed to increase their respective commitments to this program. And so our part of the deal, so to speak, was to increase our exposure level annually from $10 million to $15 million. The state's part was to provide those severity dollars that have been referenced a few times today, and it's worked fine. This is a complicated, convoluted system, but the bottom line is we do a great job of putting out fires in Oregon, so somehow it works, and we need to keep it working. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, again, Charlie Stone for the Department of Forestry. At this point on this bill, I think it's most appropriate for me to say me too. I would just make a couple quick points. As Ray pointed out, the Emergency Fire Cost Committee has its own authority, its own statutory base, and that's why the department is here testifying separately, but also in support of the bill. Representative Boquist earlier had a question about the rates, and my written testimony there has an attachment to it that shows for each of the pieces of the fund, whether it's the assessment for grazing or the minimum lots, how much money would be raised by this increase for each one of them. It totals up, as stated before, to $2,061,000 over each year. The last me too is to some of Randy's comments. I think this bill is specific to the funding of fire suppression, and that's appropriate. That's what we're doing with this language and how we pay for fires. But he raises a very good point in terms of how we keep costs down in the future and not have to keep raising it. It's prevention and fuels maintenance. And while we're still in the midst of the National Fire Plan that began back in 2000, 2001, Congress, at least if it sticks to its intentions back then, was planning funding for about 10 years for the National Fire Plan. And right now a lot of the work that's done in communities to mitigate fuels and whatnot is being paid for with federal grants. That's likely to dry up at the end of the decade. And here in the state of Oregon, I think we need to be alert to the fact that that type of behavior and that type of work needs to continue, whether there's federal money or not. So we're just kind of raising the flag on that issue. This bill is separate from that, but it's a good opportunity to raise those issues. Happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions? Three questions? We have some conflicting evidence up here whether we could have a work session on this. We have cleared it up and know we can. So this bill, I would like to have a work session today if people are ready. This one.
I was ready yesterday.
Okay. So, yes, Representative Volker.
I just want to clarify. Charlie,
And I don't know if you know the answer to this, and this may have an impact depending on the president's veto here shortly in the counties, but of the whole list of various revenues that we have on the last page, do any of these fall under tax compression, or are they all outside of tax compression, even though they're collected by the counties?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, they're outside of the tax compression. The harvest tax is a tax, but it's not part of the property tax. The others technically are not taxes because any landowner can choose to do their own protection if they have the resources and can meet the bar that the Board of Forestry sets for protecting their own lands. No one does that. They all pay the state forester or an association to provide their protection, but there is an alternative, and therefore it's not a tax. It's a voluntary assessment based on the choice the landowner makes.
Okay, can you follow up?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Charlie, give me an opportunity to beat your bandwagon here, because here's the issue, and Representative Gelser and I talked about this briefly, and she brought it up, and I'd like you to comment for the record. Out in, you know, the Starker Forest area, if you sweep out to the west, if you go along my line and Sarah's line out through Adair Village out to the west, there's a whole huge, fairly significant area of unincorporated, unrural fire department area out there. And I know that the Western Oregon District, it falls in their district, and I talked earlier, we have these $600,000 houses, a bunch of them out there, in which the only real fire protection is the Department of Forestry. And it's not in, frankly, your purview and your responsibility, but there are a whole bunch of landowners that Sarah and I share in our districts who believe incorrectly that your fire suppression pumpers, backed up by OFICs and Starker's units, are magically going to show up in the middle of August and save their houses. And I'd like you to comment on that, because they are not doing their own protection, and they are, frankly, looking for a free ride, and there is no protection.
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, this is always an area that we try to speak daintily about, and I'm no good at that. but our mandate under the statutes is to protect lives and then resources, and then only if it doesn't interfere with our ability to protect resources, to protect structures. The realities of that are really two things. One, if you're an incident commander, if you're out there running an operation, you're not going to be very cavalier about saying, let the house burn, we'll stop it over there at the road. They make an awful lot of effort to try and stop those houses. We don't enter the structures. We don't actually fight the structure fire. But an awful lot of effort is expended oftentimes trying to do perimeter control on the fire but not allow it to get to structures. But there's also a very practical reason for that. If you think in terms of fuels and forest fuels, you want to get coarse. We sometimes view homes as a giant fuel pile or slash pile, because if you get a home on fire, then you're spreading that fire again further. All those building materials and whatnot carry the fire at a distance. So there's a practical reason to fight it too. We don't have the resources. We aren't set up to do what the rural fire departments do, but we are doing some protection in the homes to the extent that we can do it through perimeter control and keeping fires from spreading from homes. But it is not our responsibility to fight the fire in the home. And if it's in a situation where it's surrounded by fuels, where we can't put people in there safely, we're not going there.
I agree. Any other questions of this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here that would like to speak to 3044 who didn't sign up? Okay. Seeing none, we will close our public hearing on 3044, and we'll open a work session on 3044, and I would entertain a motion. Representative Plum.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3044 with a due pass recommendation and refer to Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Okay. Representative Plum has moved House Bill 3044 with a due pass recommendation to the Committee on Revenue with a prior
Reference.
Thank you. Almost done.
Yeah. Give me just note back.
Okay. Any discussion?
Just one comment. Mr. Chair, I'm fully supportive of this. I just want to make sure that we know in the record, even with this increase, which is long overdue, it is not the responsibility of the Department of Forestry to respond to structural fires in the state of Oregon.
Yeah.
It's their responsibility for wildland and forest protection, and as a secondary means
addressing that issue. And I think that's going to come back up in the other bill that we are going to have before us. Yes. Because
And I would also say that I appreciate the fact that they came with a measured approach on this one. If you looked at it, you could jump to the conclusion that you really wanted to do it even more than that, because this will raise $10 million, and they know they need $15 million. But the prior history, and having been involved in the Coos County Fire Protection District, there were many years when they had built that up, and they actually had reduced the money, which happens after you get to a certain point. And for years, they stayed pretty well. And then you get a big fire, uses up all the resources, and it takes a while to build it back. But you don't need to build it all back in that first year. You have to make some assumptions based on the history that you're going to have some good years ahead of time and that this will work. And I appreciate that. I think it's the right way to proceed. So I think it's a good compromise and a thoughtful approach to this situation. So, with that, we'll take a vote.
Representative McPherson, excused. Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Smith, excused. Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Klemm?
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder?
Aye.
Chair Roblin?
Aye. Motion passes, and it's off to revenue. Thank you. So, we will close that work session on House Bill 3044, and we'll open a work session on 3468. I mean, a public hearing. Sorry about changing that. We'll close that work session. We'll open a public hearing on 3468, and we have a number of our members that may have to leave during this, and so we will continue to take the testimony, but we will not have a work session today because I don't know we'll have enough people at the end. So, with that, start description.
Thank you, Chair. House Bill 3468 does have a subsequent referral to revenue and then ways and means. It does create a privileged tax of 2 cents per 1,000 feet for harvesting merchantable forest products to administer the Oregon Smoke Management Plan. Limits these expenditures to 40% or less of total expenditures approved by the legislature for the program or the management program, and appropriates $240,000 from General Fund to Department of Forestry for the smoke management program. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. And with that, Charlie Stone, must be your day here today. Do we want to have Mike from FIC come as well? And we could actually have Gregory R. McLaren also from Deschutes to come on all up.
Sure.
Okay.
Oh.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, again, Charlie Stone for the Department of Forestry. I promise not to come back at least until next Tuesday.
Okay.
House Bill 3468 is kind of a companion piece. We had House Bill 2973 before the committee a couple weeks ago that dealt with the policy elements of the Oregon Smoke Management Plan. And at that time, we talked to you a little bit about the Smoke Management Review Committee that had brought forward those recommendations. And the other folks that are going to testify will probably talk about that a little bit more. I just want to get kind of to the technical pieces. This bill asks to bring some more money and change the structure of the funding of the Smoke Management Plan. The Smoke Management Plan first came into existence in 1969, and I think at that time was probably funded out of the fire program, but don't recall that for sure. Actually, I wasn't around here at that time. But from the late 70s on, it was budgeted and funded through the Forest Practices Program, which traditionally has been 60% general fund, 40% forest products harvest tax. And then in 1991, when there was a move to expand the program and add some resources to the smoke management program, we instituted a system of burn fees that the landowners pay. They pay a registration fee when they first tell the forester that they're planning on doing burning, 50 cents to the acre. And then once they've reported their accomplishment, then they pay an additional burn fee for the acres that were accomplished out there. And currently that fee is $5 an acre. Up until 2003, it was $5 for broadcast burning, but only $2 an acre for pile burning, which is the bulk of it these days. And what happened in 2003, if you all recall, we'd just gone through the several special sessions in 2002. We had the general fund shortfall, and the general fund money was stripped out of the smoke management program completely. because it had always operated on a match with the harvest tax, we stopped spending the harvest tax money, and the program's been operating exclusively off of burn fees since 2004. We had to raise the rates, and we've also had to reduce the program to some extent in doing that. Now, with the review committee recommendations, we're trying to bring in some improvements, bring some technologies to bear on the program, possibly increase the program by a position. The position increase is in the governor's recommended budget, shifting the budget from the forest practices program to the fire program, where it really fits with everything else that goes on in the program, is in the governor's recommended budget. But these increases of general fund and reinstituting the harvest tax are not in the governor's recommended budget, but we were given permission by the governor's staff to shop this bill, and it was actually the committee that introduced the bill on our behalf. So it's a little bit of an oddity from that standpoint. The basics of it is that because the program would no longer be under forest practices, we'd have to put a new element in the statute that would say 2 cents per 1,000 board foot harvest tax would go specifically to the smoke management program and into the smoke management revolving fund. And the bill also asks for a $240,000 biennium general fund appropriation. That reestablishes that 60-40 match on harvest tax and general fund, because 2 cents per 1,000 board feet and an approximate 4 billion board feet of harvest per year would generate $160,000 in the biennium. We'll still have burn fees. Burn fees would make up about 50% of the overall budget for smoke management. And so in the end, you'd have 50% burn fees, 20% harvest tax, 30% general fund. That's the basics of the proposal. We'd ask the committee to endorse that by offering to send this on to revenue and then ways and means, so that the details can be worked out, and be happy to answer questions.
Any questions?
Oh, yeah, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thanks.
Chair Roble, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Deichsel with the Oregon Forest Industries Council, Director of Forest Protection. Was also up here with Charlie last time with 2973. Explained to the group a little bit about the Smoke Management Review Committee, lasting 30 months, 11-member Citizens Advisory Committee. Took us a long time to come to consensus recommendations. I think we've been through most of that. The new technology, improved coordination, ability to forecast the most appropriate days to burn under the best conditions are going to be a win for meeting our accomplishments, as well as protecting the air quality in the populated areas. That's the goal of the program. My testimony, Charlie gave you a few dates. We conflict a little bit, but I put a few fun facts there with kind of the history of dates when fees were initiated, noting that 69 was the formation of Oregon's smoke management program, the first in the nation. When the fees were increased, generally as a result of the shrinking general fund contributions to the program. The one little text in the towards the middle there of page 2 kind of highlights the general fund components dating back from 1909-01 and the subsequent drop over time. And as Charlie pointed out, those have continued to come back and purely be run the program on user fees. The recommendations that my partner here, Gregory, was also a member of the review committee, it was a three-legged stool, as he likes to refer to it as, is that 2973 is the policy aspects that change it to a statewide program. The rules program that we're currently working with the Board of Forestry and the Environmental Quality Commission is the nuts and bolts of how you do it on a day-in, day-out basis. And how to put it all together is 3468, which is kind of a restoring of general fund component. So I'll kind of leave it at that. It is kind of a... it helped to justify the shared responsibility of public funding for a smoke management program, but in complying with Federal Clean Air Act requirements, regional haze rules, continued shrinkage of monitoring of particulate matter down to PM 2.5, the communities that are trying to protect that air quality in areas where they continue to use wood stoves as their predominant source of heat in some of the rural communities in the state, they're very concerned with this, and I think maintaining a better quality and program to lessen the impact of forest burning on those communities is going to be a win. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. You might look at Greg.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee. I'm for the record, I'm Gregory McLaren. I'm a small business owner living in Redmond, Oregon. And I was a member of the 30-month-long consensus committee of the Smoke Management Review Committee. I also happen to have a very small woodlot in Chair Roblin's home district, Coos County, and we enjoy it. As Mr. Dykstra has indicated, there were 39 integrated recommendations that came out of the Smoke Management Review Committee. And at the time, we didn't think about it as a three-legged stool, but I do think of it as a three-legged stool. There's policy parts, there's OAR revisions that Mr. Dykstra and Charlie Stone refer to that are moving forward, and then there's the funding aspect of it. It's a complete package that public fundings through general funds is critical and appropriate because the smoke management program is a dual goal program. It is charged with protecting the air quality of the state of Oregon, which is amongst the cleanest in the nation, and forest fuel reduction, which gets at the heart of having a sustainable forest industry, which is so important still to our state in spite of other things that have gone on. The review committee recognized that there is broad public benefit, and while user fees should support the industry functions, the legislature was in error, with all due respect, to zero out general funds years ago. All citizens benefit by having a fully functioning dual goal program through better air, quality of life, and economic opportunity. Hence the three-legged stool. And I will not repeat that. It does provide, through 3468, a stable funding base going forward. And we of the committee felt that was critical. And I urge your support today, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Bopas.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Charlie, could you just give me a quick, what's the what do we raise now from the burning fees per year?
Per year, Chair Roland, Representative Boquist, per year, I think right now we're bringing in about $350,000 a year. We're running the program currently on somewhere in the neighborhood of $280,000 to $300,000. We're actually building a surplus right now. When we raised the rates in 2004, we overshot a little bit. And by, if this bill passes, it's going to allow us to lower those rates back down again and still generate about half of it through burn fees.
Thank you. And workforce. I guess my concern, and the chair, I guess my concern is I don't have a problem with the program at all, and the expectations with OFIC and the Small Woodlands Association and everything else. But my fear is that this is not in the governor's budget. It's clearly not in the co-chair's budgets downstairs. And my fear is. We get this, we push this over revenue, and then revenue pushes it downstairs, and what happens is we may get the needed program, and we get the needed 2-cent tax, but we don't get the general fund dollars, which therefore means, in fact, and I'm really speaking out loud here, in fact, what happens then is we don't reduce the burn fee as much as we would have anticipated. And that's more of a statement. It's not a question for you folks, but I think everybody needs to be aware that that fear exists if we send it downstairs, that there is a chance, depending on how well you gentlemen testify in the next two committees, that we could get the program, not get the reduction on the burning fees, might get a small reduction. So that is my concern. Very supportive of the concept, but one needs to be realistic on the budgeting process in the basement.
Yes, it would come to not the basement, down the hall.
Any other questions for this group?
No.
Thank you very much. Are there any other people here who would like to talk about 3468? Okay. If not, we'll close our public hearing on 3468. And I would entertain a motion from Representative Clem to allow Representative McPherson to vote on our two vote bills that we voted on today. So I'm going to tap in to a work session on House Bill 3044 and also at the same time House Bill 2962, which we moved to the other committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the committee suspend the rules in order to allow Representative McPherson to vote I'm not supposed to say which way he's going to vote. So to vote on. Should we direct?
I have a question though, yes. Mr. Chair. The first one was without a recommendation.
Without a recommendation.
Right. So
and it'll still be without a recommendation.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So to vote on House Bills 3044 and 2962.
Yeah. So that he knows it's 30. Representative Clem has requested this rule suspension so that he may vote on House Bills 3044 and 2962. Any objection? Seeing no objection, and then I will ask Representative McPherson how he would like to vote on House Bill 3044. The motion at the time was for a do pass recommendation from our committee to the Committee on Revenue.
Mm-hmm. And I will vote aye on that motion, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And on 2962, the motion was without recommendation to send that bill to the Committee on Economic and Workforce Development.
And I will vote aye on that motion as well.
Thank you very much. Then we will close the work sessions on House Bill 3044 and 2962.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your courtesy.
And thank you to all of the committee. We will. Any other things that you would like to come up before our committee today?
So we're not doing 2293?
Well, let's go with this. Look, everybody's here.
Why don't we vote on 2293?
I feel pretty comfortable with that one, too. And I want to make sure that we had it listed as a possible suggestion.
No, we took it off because we had every
No, this one. Oh. Now, 3468 was under possible recommendation.
Work session.
Okay. Any interest in getting that one discussed?
I would like to move. That's the one we just discussed, right?
Yeah, we did.
I would like to move it now.
I think that's a good idea. So, okay, we will open a work session on 3468.
That's
revenue. Mr. Chair, I would like to move House Bill 3468 to. Did I say both? To revenue. It's got an additional referral to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Clem has moved House Bill 3468 to the Committee on Revenue and with subsequent referral to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Do I have any discussion? Seeing none, let's have a vote.
Representative Maurer.
Excused.
Representative Smith. Excused. Representative Brooklyn.
Aye.
Representative Clem.
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair
Rowland? Aye. So, House Bill 3468 has passed. And we'll close our work session on 3468. Committee, appreciate all the work that we did. We're kind of one of the last committees here today, I think. Yeah. We're still working, so I appreciate all that. Any other business that... Oh, 23.
Missing the amendments.
The amendments did not make it, so we pushed it till next Tuesday. So
okay, got it.
And everybody wanted to read the amendments very carefully before they actually, as you know, what happens when they put these things.
Which one's that?
So.
2293, the Forest Resource Trust Bill.
Right. We moved that one. And yes, right, Representative McPherson wasn't here for that either, but we moved that to Tuesday because the amendments didn't come on Tuesday.
Okay, very good.
So with that, we will close our committee hearing on Ag and Natural Resources, and I thank everyone for attending. We appreciate you being here, and thank you, committee members.